agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to the Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Hey, Jay, how you doing?
I'm good, Mike. It's been a rough week defending but fruitful week defending freedom, I guess, is probably the best way to put it, right?
Well, that's always good if you feel like it's been at least a fruitful week. I know I've been away from this show for a few weeks, and it's been a rough week for me. Many folks know I'm a big time dog person, and Ernie, my aging lab and kind of my best guy there, he nearly died. He has this thing called hemorrhagic gastroenteritis, which is every bit as awful as it sounds. And after just 3 days in the emergency vet hospital and all kinds of different antibiotics, poor guy, I got him home and he had six different areas on him that were shaved for IV ports. And so it was a near miss. And that just sort of put me into a bit of a very rough time. So it was good that I had Trey, you and Trey and Ken to take over the show, because I was in pretty bad shape, and so was Ernie. But everything is doing much better now. So I am ready to get back to the show. Though I've decided that in honor of Ernie this week, the picture that goes with on the website with every week's episode, it's going to be a recovered Ernie picture, just because
tribute to Ernie.
There you go, tribute to Ernie. So anyway, before we get going, I want to thank our newest supporters, John and Darren. Thank you guys very much. And of course, when you are a Patreon supporter, you get that second full-length bonus episode every week, and also various other things at other levels of support. And to check it all out, just go to patreon.com/politicsguys. And if you would like to get that weekly bonus show, but you're just not in the place where you can afford to financially support us right now, totally understandable, happy to help you out. Just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will get you set up with that bonus episode. And also, if you're just anti-Patreon for whatever reason, you can also support us through PayPal and on Venmo. We're at Politics Guys, and to check out those options, just go to politicsguys.com/support. So today we have a lot to talk about: the recently passed infrastructure bill and the status of Build Back Better, Tuesday's elections, of course, oral arguments in two big Supreme Court cases, Senate Republicans filibustering the John Lewis voting rights bill, and if we have time, maybe some listener questions and comments. That will be more than enough for two full-length episodes for sure. But before we get started with any of that, we're going to take a quick break and we will be right back. Okay, Jay, one thing I wanted to get into just very quickly before we get started. A couple of weeks ago, you were on the show with Trey, and you mentioned a story about Kissinger and Zhou Enlai. Did I get that pronunciation right, I think?
Zhou Enlai.
Zhou Enlai, there you go.
They always change it on you, right?
Yeah, but
they make themselves sound smarter.
Yeah, and you mentioned that story is apocryphal, right? And it reminded me of a great phrase I wanted to share with folks I came across. It's Italian. It's called, the phrase is ben trovato, and it means characteristic or appropriate, even if not true. And I love that phrase, and I like to share it with whoever I can, because it's even better, I think, than apocryphal, because, of course, apocryphal stories can be characteristic or not. But that seemed to me to be very ben trovato, and I wanted to pass that along, so.
I like that.
Yeah, I thought you might, actually. So anyway, ben trovato aside, we'll get started with, the very late breaking news. Late Friday night, House Democrats finally pushed through their smaller but still huge part of their ambitious agenda by passing the $1 trillion infrastructure bill in a 228-206 vote, with 13 Republicans joining Democrats and 6 progressive Democrats refusing to support the measure. Now, this was previously passed by the Senate in a 69-30 vote, and so now it goes to President Biden, who will very quickly sign it into law. And as we discussed before, it provides $550 billion in new funds over a decade for roads, bridges, the power grid, internet infrastructure, as well as around $47 billion in resiliency funding to help deal with the effects of climate change. Now, this vote came after, well, a very long and contentious dispute in the Democratic Party between centrists and the progressive wing, with enough progressives finally giving way and supporting the infrastructure bill before a vote on that significantly larger Build Back Better legislation. And earlier in the day, Speaker Pelosi seemed to think that, according to her secret speaker's whip count, she had the votes to pass both bills, but centrist Democrats refused to support Build Back Better until they saw official cost estimates from the CBO, and that's going to take a couple of weeks. But then after receiving assurances from the moderates that they would support Build Back Better if the CBO's estimates were in line with unofficial estimates from the White House, the way was essentially cleared for that infrastructure vote. And so while the prospects, I think, from my view, for Build Back Better in a significantly slimmed down, it's $1.7 trillion. It's weird to call that slimmed down, right, Jay? But it is. I mean, from the original, I think the prospects look increasingly good in the House. There's still that key question of course, what will Manchin and to a somewhat lesser extent, Sinema go for? Because, and this brings in Tuesday's elections, you know, in the aftermath of the elections, Manchin seemed to draw the conclusion that Democrats need to do less. He had an interview with Fox, Brett Baer from Fox News, and he said, "I hope it's a wake-up call for all of us. I'm concerned. I've been talking about our debt. I've been talking about inflation. I've been talking about the fallout we may have," and meant from that spending, from those spending bills. And even maybe more ominously, when he's asked by Baer if he thought the Democratic Party had essentially left him behind, he said, "I'm a West Virginia Democrat, but I don't know. I don't know where maybe I belong at times, but I believe I'm fiscally responsible and socially compassionate." And you know what? I have a lot of
Like me, Mike.
That's what I was thinking, you know? Exactly. But before you draw too much from that, a few weeks ago, he told reporters that, you know, this idea that he would leave the Democratic Party were, in his words, bullshit with a capital B. And he said that McConnell has tried to get him to come over to the Republican Party a number of times, but that he couldn't do it, Manchin, that is, couldn't do it, because he felt he was too far from Republicans on taxes and health care. So, you know, that's kind of where we're at this point, Jay, with both of these pieces of legislation. So why don't we start with the one that actually passed and very shortly, likely by the time a lot of listeners are hearing this, will actually be law, the infrastructure bill. What are your thoughts on this week in Democratic infighting and some progress, at least for them?
Well, it looks like they finally took my advice, doesn't it?
Remind listeners, yeah.
Obviously. When I was on with Trey, when I was on with you, that, you know, we raised the issue of, or the idea of, look, if you've got one very large infrastructure bill, something that, I can still quibble on, wow, that's spending a lot of money, and there are a lot of things that are seemingly to be counted as infrastructure that most people wouldn't really consider infrastructure. And the sheer number of it, you would think this would be sort of like this would have been like a dream of the Clinton administration, which is saying something. But they had that in hand, and they've had that in hand since early in the summer. There was this ludicrously goofy idea of, well, we have to tie the two together. And it just didn't work. And they could have gone forward with this. They had the votes. Yet their progressive caucus sort of hijacked them and left them doing this looking silly, I guess, for quite a while. And they still don't have what they want. So this was a loss for the progressive caucus. It was a victory for sanity and getting sort of half a loaf and fighting one playing one game at a time. So I think it's, well, you know, again, on policy grounds, I can certainly object to some things in that bill, but there's also some things that I think I like and I think that are needed, right? We need to have infrastructure. We need to do improvements on that, those types of things. And there are going to be other things like, you know, more broadband internet access that is maybe not necessarily your traditional roads and bridges infrastructure, but I would say is 21st century infrastructure and is necessary. So, yeah, I mean, I don't hate the bill. I don't love it. But I do love that this is sort of going the route of sanity, if you will, rather than tying, you know, saying here is let's call it moderate infrastructure bill. But, you know, we only vote on it unless you pass the immoderate Build Back Better bill.
Yeah, you know, and I think obviously anything that gets 69 votes in the Senate in today's polarized environment, there's obviously a lot going for it. Certainly, that's definitely bipartisan. And you know, even the House vote was at least somewhat bipartisan with those 13 almost all kind of centrist Republicans joining Democrats. So yeah, I think that, you know, if we pull back and say, well, who's it a win for? I think it's a win for the country as a general thing. You know, it's nice to see legislation passing like this. Now pulling back and looking at that, you know, you said tying it to the Build Back Better legislation was ludicrous, and I see what you're saying, but it's hard, I think, sometimes to separate what's kind of posturing and negotiating stances from what people who are taking those positions actually expect the final result to be. It's you know, any sort of bargaining, you start from those sort of more extreme positions and kind of work your way back to something. And so I think there's a lot of that. And the media has focused an awful lot of attention on these bills, as it should have, right? Because they are enormous pieces of legislation. But a lot of the sausage making stuff, I've said from the beginning that this is the pretty standard type stuff. And in the end, I think it's not going to matter a whole heck of a lot. And that's still how I feel about this.
Ooh, see, I differ with you on the standard. I mean, from a procedural standpoint, the idea of tying one, bill with bipartisan support, and we'll call it a moderate bill, having that in quotes. But, you know, this kind of happened, and this is, you know, I think a lot of Republicans were resentful, rightfully so. When after this passed the Senate, Biden said, okay, great, congratulations, you know what? I'm not going to sign this unless you pass the other thing too. Now he backtracked on that, but the House took him literally, if not seriously, and went forward with this tying the two bills together. And if the idea is, well, look, the country moving forward and compromising on areas of bipartisan agreement is a good thing, then this strategy of saying, okay, we will agree to the reasonable bipartisan piece, but only if you agree to the outside ludicrous leftist piece. That seems to defeat that purpose, right?
No, I don't agree. I don't agree at all, because I guess I'm rejecting your premise. I never thought that the Progressive Caucus was going to just walk away from either of these two things. And again, this is the sort of thing that maybe in a previous time...
Well, they didn't have to walk away. I'm saying, listen, you pass one bill and then you pass another.
Yeah, but the concern is that you pass one bill and then you lose a lot of your leverage. And so they were just trying to extract as much leverage as they could out of the situation. And given the fact that there are such razor thin margins, those few votes, those folks can have an increasing, you know, amount of leverage. And so I think actually that the fact that it looks to me like by the end of the year, we're going to have, in fact, by the end of November, I'm betting we're going to have, well, maybe by the end of the year, we're going to have both of these pieces of legislation. Given the fact that there is such a slim majority for the Democrats in the House and really just a tie in the Senate. I think that is really impressive. And the Democrats should get, will be able to look back and say, wow, we did an awful lot with not a lot of room for error.
Well, we'll see. Although, again, the progressive demand from the beginning was no infrastructure bill unless and until Build Back Better is passed. And they've lost that. If this was about leverage, they've lost that fight. To me, again, that was always a fight they were going to lose. But
well, no, see, I'll argue with you on that, because I think that the most that they could get, in the end, they realized the most they could get was a commitment from those centrists who were holding it up. And the commitment was, well, as long as the CBO estimates are in line with the White House estimates, we will vote for this. And that was the most they could get. They extracted the most they could get. And sure, it's a loss in the sense that if they had their way, it would be $3, 4, 5, 6, 7 trillion. But, you know, the fact of the matter is the math is the math and the votes are the votes. And, there was a centrist Democrat, I believe, from Virginia, I think, who in the House, who said, you know, people didn't elect Joe Biden to be FDR. But of course, progressives hoped he would be FDR. But I mean, essentially, they're right, is that, you know, there aren't those kind of majorities. There isn't that kind of broad based national support. And while that might play really well in AOC's or Jay Powell's district or Bush's district, the fact of the matter is there's just not enough overall support in the country to make that sort of thing happen. And so to me, the system is working exactly like it should. And sure, the sausage making process is messy, but that's OK.
So the difficulty they have there is, though, there's still no guarantee in the Senate.
No, and
Plan A was everything gets passed first, and then infrastructure gets passed. Right? Senate passes Build Back Better, House passes it, then Senate passes it, then House passes infrastructure.
Yeah, and my sense
was Plan A.
My sense of things is that again that. There's going to be something that will be, I mean, there have been negotiations this past week, and Manchin and Sinema haven't come out and said, well, we clearly support this. They still have concerns. And I think they're trying to extract as much leverage as they can, understandably. So Sinema is kind of a weird case. She's an odd individual, I think, in a lot of ways. But in terms of Manchin, you know, he gets a lot of heat. And even on our Facebook group, listeners have said things like, well, you know, Manchin is the worst, just this awful senator, the worst senator. There was a progressive podcast that he's the worst person in the U.S. Senate. It's like, have you met, you know, Hawley and Cruz? But I understand their disappointment, but you got to look at it from Manchin's standpoint, right? I mean, it's amazing, I think, that there's a Democratic U.S. Senator from West Virginia in the first place. And honestly, as a Democrat, I'm happy for whatever votes Joe Manchin can give my party and my party's priorities and his party as well. And honestly, I expect that behind closed doors, both Manchin and Democratic Party leaders have decided where they're going to play up differences between the two as much as possible, because that's only going to help Manchin back home.
You don't think that
you don't think that Joe Manchin, in a state that Trump won by what, 30-something%, a state that in his last election he barely squeaked through, you don't think he's saying to other Democratic leaders, saying, listen, it would really help if it looks like I'm on board with not a whole lot. I mean, how would he would have to be strategically inept to not make that argument. You know, you always say that the Democrats seem to be able to play this game really well. Wouldn't that be an example
of
that?
Yeah. No, but I do think that, you know, for example, that he and Chuck Schumer are sitting back after hours saying, hey, look, Joe, I want you to hold this up because it's going to make us all look good. I don't think that's the case.
No, not make us all look good. Make Manchin look better to his constituents in West Virginia. Now, there are some
the argument, as I understood what you're saying, is, well, that helps Schumer in the long run because it helps, you know, keep control of the Senate,
gotcha.
Right?
They don't risk
losing a Senate seat.
Which I think they're going to lose anyway, but yeah.
That's possible.
You take a look at take a look at Manchin's wins. Unless he becomes an American independent or something like that that he'd been talking about, I just don't see that. But that's that's longer term.
Yeah, and Trump took West Virginia by some ungodly margin.
Yeah, 30-something percent.
I think a poll I had seen, this is from probably a month or two ago, showed that of states where Joe Biden's popularity was lowest, West Virginia was the number one state where he was hurting. So, I don't think there's that going on. I think it is just a plain old one. He's a West Virginia Democrat, like he says, and he is. It's a matter of political survival. So
and not only that, but political survival, but looking at what his constituents actually want, and also
that's what I mean. It's kind of the same thing.
Ideally, it is the same thing. Yeah, and a lot of folks saying that he's in the pocket of the fossil fuel industry. Well, I mean, I certainly disagree with his stances, but coming from West Virginia, I understand why he is supporting those. And are there some financial issues involved? Yeah, I think you can certainly make that case. But again, I think of the alternative, and the alternative, which would seem far more likely if you look at the numbers, is that West Virginia has two Republican senators, it's not a case of any of this stuff happening. So
not Mitt Romney Republican senators.
really serious hardcore Republican senators. So, again,
more of the Josh Hawley model, probably.
Exactly. But again, I think, we're going to look back on this and in a few months and say, well, that was pretty impressive. And I'll point out that, there's generally a very narrow window for these things to happen. For instance, you typically get, if you are fortunate enough to have unified control of government by the slimmest of margins, you usually only have it for a couple of years. And so you get one crack. Basically, I mean, Obama had the Affordable Care Act and also that the financial bailout kind of legislation, which was sort of, crisis related. Trump had the tax cut, and now Biden's going to get, I think, these two things, and that's going to be it. But that's sort of what you should, what you should expect, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there you go. And that's going to be, I think that this will pretty much be it in terms of major accomplishments for the Biden administration. And maybe that will be enough. Maybe not. I don't know. But, this obviously all ties in to a certain extent, I think, to the elections on Tuesday. And so why don't we turn to that? But before we do, we'll just take a quick break and be right back. Okay, Jay. So, there's 1 year to go, a little less than 1 year to go, I guess, till the 2022 congressional midterm elections. And a lot of people were looking to last Tuesday's elections as a possible sign of things to come. And the most followed of these elections was, I think, clearly the Virginia governor's race, where polling before the election indicated a pretty tight contest between Democrat Terry McAuliffe, who was governor from 2014 to 2018, and Republican challenger and financial executive Glenn Youngkin, who was making his first bid for elective office. And Youngkin actually ended up winning by 2.5% over McAuliffe, which has, I think, sent a lot of folks in the Democratic Party and the media, and I know you'll say they're kind of very related, right, into a kind of a frenzy, and a frenzy of overanalyzing, at least kind of in my view on this. But no matter how you look at it, I think it's unquestionable that last week, not just Virginia, but in a lot of ways, was a good week electorally for Republicans. But before I get into my thoughts on it, what did you take away from Tuesday's elections?
So I will begin with my caveat, and this is something I say over all sort of midterm or non-presidential elections is, well, I shouldn't say midterm. I'd say let's call it special elections, off-year elections.
Off-year, there you go.
Is that, there is a temptation to read more into it than is there.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that's always out there, because off-year elections tend to be more individualized, right? It turns on campaigns and the politics of the state and the candidates. And just as I cautioned the same thing about California, right, that people shouldn't read too much into the California recall. As it turned out, it was sort of California being California. So do I infer that there is some larger trend, bigger wave here? I'm not going to make that prediction, but I think I do want to say something that it's significant in that it's certainly not nothing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And to me, the bigger piece of this, which is going to become clear down the road. Let me back up. I would say Youngkin ran an excellent campaign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He did a whole lot right. In terms of messaging, in terms of reaching out, in terms of the issues that I don't know whether necessarily he chose the issues or the issues chose him. But in walking that line of keeping the Trump fans with him, but not embracing Donald Trump, not being caught up in what McAuliffe was pitching, that this is a Trump clone and stuff, which sort of was pretty implausible on its face. But it's kind of worked in the past. So there's that too, right? I think we take into account that, listen, not every candidate is going to do as well as Youngkin did in actually running the campaign in message discipline and so forth. But three, and this is the piece I think that's going to matter down the road, is this was sort of a change. I think that, again, when I was talking to Trey, I talked about there was just this feeling that conservatives have, right, that have had lately that, listen, they're worried, they're scared. I mean, and scared isn't, I don't think that's too big of a word to use. When you had things like the Merrick Garland, school board memo and so forth, that there is just this increasing reach into all aspects of your private life. And also throw out the IRS rule that's still pending out there as far as looking at your individual bank accounts. But that's there. And the response, the Democrat playbook had always been, well, you're racist. And they very much tried to play that card in Virginia. Up even to the what I would say absolutely abominable conduct of the so-called Lincoln Project, who have besmirched the name of probably our greatest president,
after
that
Trump.
Sort of if people aren't familiar with what I'm referring to, this was the Lincoln Project, which arguably builds itself originally as sort of, well, we're, you know, the real Republicans opposing Trumpism and so forth. But now they're just sort of a wing of the Democratic Party.
It's just this embarrassing mess of sad, self-promoting, awful people, well,
people who are in for the money, who stopped getting paid by Republicans after they lost enough races. And now they're willing to work for the Democrats, but staged sort of a false flag operation of guys with tiki torches, which was reminiscent of the Charlottesville rally. And the McAuliffe campaign, jumped all over it.
Working for the Republicans, Jay. It was a double false flag.
Well, I guess
it's three-dimensional chess.
Again, I don't think the Lincoln Project is really working for the Republicans. No, I think they're working cash.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
But this, all of a sudden, you got this sense when Youngkin won, and I didn't think he was going to. Things, and there was this sense of momentum shift. Right. Nationally. And this is just sort of how my emotionally I'm kind of processing it, that all of a sudden the big, scary But the spell had been lifted, if you will. And I'll let you go for a while because I've been going for much too long.
Well,
and then I'll jump back in. But
well, let me say I wasn't surprised at all that Youngkin won. I expected him to win when the polling was even. I just assume still at this point when I see any sort of poll that I'm going to add a couple 2-3% at least to the Republican numbers, because I still don't think polling organizations have figured out how to, most of them at least, figured out how to adjust for Republican non-response or conservative non-response. And so not only
I think that's right, and I do the same.
Yeah, so there you go. Yes. So not only that, though, but if you take a look at the fundamentals, the media hates fundamentals analysis because it's nothing new. But what we know from decades of history in West Virginia and just larger history, or Virginia and just larger history, is that in off year, in midterm elections, when the party in power, especially when there's an unpopular president and Biden's approval is 42.9 and sinking and has been for a while since late August, that they're going to do poorly. And so anyone who would just look at electoral history and those fundamentals would have to say, well, yeah, Democrats should prepare to not do very well. And, you know, when I saw these ridiculous hyperbole, I think, from the media, you know, disaster, devastating, debacle, they like the alliteration, I guess, with Democrats, you know. But again, how is this surprising? Especially, I think, when you have a candidate like McAuliffe, who at least at one point just so clearly put his foot in it and made like an ideal soundbite. You know, here's one lesson I pull away. Don't tell parents that they shouldn't interfere with their kids' education. That's not a smart idea, right? And that was maybe a verbal slip up. You know, it was, I'm sure, but
I don't know.
But
do you think it was a verbal slip up, or it was of the sort of a gaffe is when a politician accidentally tells the truth, you know, or reveals their real feelings?
You know, I think it's hard to say, but let me just, before we get to that, I just want to emphasize the larger point that what I think the media does a poor job of, and people do as well, is they tend to look at idiosyncratic factors to understand why people won or lost. They ran a good campaign or they ran a bad campaign. But, you know, as a political scientist, I say, well, sure, that can matter at the margins. But what accounts for most of what we see are these larger factors, the state of the economy, these, you know, these big things that individual candidates can't really control. I'm not saying that campaigns don't matter, but I'm saying they, number one, there's a lot of research and a lot of history that shows that they matter a lot less than people think. But those differences in terms of how much they matter are overemphasized by the media because they want something to cover. And so that, I think, is a really important background for people to kind of keep in mind when we think about this, and also when we think about what I see to be the inevitable losses for Democrats in the midterms.
Yeah. So, well, that's interesting, because you're sort of taking a little bit of the, again, for people, Foundation fans, Harry Seldon mathematical psychohistory approach.
Your recommendation a few weeks ago. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, I recommended that a while ago, and I still do. I think almost, to me, I'm seeing it almost the opposite way. And it comes down to there's sort of some big theories in history and in politics that this is bigger than for us to get into one day. But one is sort of the great man theory, right? That there are these incredible individuals who make events and change events and change the course of history. And the other is more, as you would point out, there are larger historical forces and there are people who sort of rise and fall according to them, but are necessarily outside of their control. And I think the truth probably lies somewhere in between.
Yes.
You know, and that's probably not fair to a big philosophical debate to just say, yeah, it's probably in between, but that's for another day.
But let me say on that, you're not necessarily saying that it's right in between. I think, you know, I think people can differ in saying which is more predictive. And I would certainly say that. Well, I think it's largely these bigger factors, but certainly individuals can come on the stage and make a real difference. And I think Donald Trump is a prime example of that.
Yeah. Although, I mean, again, if you're really smart, if you're really smart in the bigger waves, Harry Seldon type logic, it's sort of you would say, well, the math would predict a Donald Trump at some point. Whether it's Donald Trump himself or just someone else like him.
Yeah.
But that setting that aside, so now I lost myself.
While you're coming, let me just say on the education, and that's obviously ties into the critical race theory thing, right? Because that's what the education issue was sort of branded as, and I think Republicans did a really good job of that. And you know, I want to point out on that, it seems to me what Democrats can take away from that is one lesson is don't try to be nuanced on this critical race theory issue. It seems to me that it doesn't matter if people don't actually know what critical race theory means, because most people, you know, don't. It doesn't matter that it's not actually being taught in public schools. And it doesn't matter if you think it should be taught in public schools. I think if you're a Democrat running for office and this comes up, you say something like people have a lot of different ideas about what critical race theory is, but I think that kids should be given the facts about history of race in the United States without any bias or without any attempt to indoctrinate them into a specific view. And that's where I would begin and end my discussion of critical race theory. And I think,
amen.
You know?
Amen. And you would have, I think that would have been a much, much better response than we're in charge of, you know, you have no say over what your kids learn.
Because, yeah, and, you know, I think this more nuanced and dangerous approach to say is, well, I think it's healthy to teach critical race theory as a perspective. Say, no, maybe it is. In fact, you know, I agree that it is at least, it shouldn't be indoctrinated, but it's reasonable to teach it as a perspective. But why go into those waters where you're just there, you know, there are landmines, there are mines everywhere in those waters. Yeah, that would be weird.
All over the place.
Yeah, exactly. So that to me is just, there should be a clear, and I think the Democrats, most Democrats are going to learn that lesson from this. And because education, understandably, for people who have kids, and a lot of people have kids, that's, you know, you're messing with my kid's education. You're telling me I can't mess with it. That's a great issue for Republicans, and I think Democrats maybe have learned that sort of playing the race card, as you put it, and I agree on this issue. Again, regardless of whether or not you think that's the right thing electorally, that is not going to be a great strategy.
Yeah. So, and this is, again, I could, you know, this is one of these things, Mike, I was doing a lot of driving the last couple of days. And I, in my head, I have all these sort of discussions with you of, oh, this is what I'm going to say.
Uh-huh,
and then
me too,
blank on it. And then, or things take a different direction. But no, I think you're exactly right. And I've said this a lot of times that the strategy of calling the voters a bunch of racist morons just doesn't seem to work. You know, it's, you know, the, you're all a bunch of racist morons. Why won't these racist morons vote for us? You know? And I do think that's a lot of what happened. And there was a smugness, right, that comes from that. And on the critical race theory, you know, sort of arose by any other name. I think there is this weird hang up of, well, is this critical race theory or isn't it? Who cares? I think the response is parents know, they see these lessons that their kids are being taught, and about, you know, the white kid should identify themselves as oppressors and so forth. And these various, and you've seen them out there too. And you see the textbook saying, well, this is, you know, everything needs to be viewed through the lens of race, and the sort of the 1619 curriculum and so forth. And whether that's technically critical race theory or not, it's something that parents find objectionable, and I find objectionable for a whole lot of reasons. And then to get the response of, oh, you moron, you don't even know what critical race theory is. And, you know, and your critical race theory is almost, if I were to sum it up, almost, right, it's sort of the theory that, look, even if you think you're not a racist, you really are. You're just too stupid to know it. And again, that's not a winning political message.
No. And again, I think, you know, I think there's a case to be made for presenting it in such a way as, well, here is what some people believe and here's why. But that's, you're right.
Mike, I would say, especially at the college level, right? I think it's something different there than as opposed to K through 12.
Absolutely. You know,
especially in the K end of it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And you're right. In some instances, there have been instances where it seems like this is just being treated as a theory in the same way that evolution is treated as a theory. But yeah, but of course, we know this is true, but we'll call it a theory. But so, yeah, I object to that. I object to that as well. So I think we're kind of, even though you and I certainly differ in the extent to which we believe that that sort of unconscious racism and systemic bias is a real thing, I think we both agree that politically kind of focusing on that as an issue is bad for Democrats and good for Republicans. You know,
right. which that brings me to the other point I wanted to make on that Virginia election, and this is the one that, again, down the road will be more important than Glenn Youngkin, and that is Winsome Sears, mm-hmm. who was elected lieutenant governor. Oddly enough, and Virginia's got a lot of weird ways of doing things, which we should mention in a minute. But Winsome Sears, who is a Jamaican immigrant, a woman of color, you're never a former Marine, right, Mike?
That's right. That's right.
A Marine ran the outreach for the homeless. So that, I mean, she's done a lot. It really had an outstanding, shocking. I mean, you know, you look at this person and you say, "Wow, this is a truly impressive person." One in Virginia, and one against the winds of Democrats who were telling anyone who would vote for Glenn Youngkin. And I'm guessing that the overlap between Glenn Youngkin voters and Winsome Sears voters was probably close to 100%, that they are, racist. Yeah. And that's, you know, or they're white, not even worse than racist, right? They're white supremacists.
Yeah.
And if you look at the vote turned out, you elected a black immigrant woman as the lieutenant governor. These white supremacists, that's who they voted for. And they also a Hispanic or Latino attorney general that was the white supremacist candidate of choice. Whereas in this bizarre world, the anti-racists, as they call themselves, were supporting a former attorney general who dressed up either in blackface or as a Klansman, not sure which, can't really remember. And I mean, it's just this bizarre sort of backwards world. And that's when I say sort of that the spell was lifted a little bit, right? And there was this crack of light that people said, no, this is this being called a racist all the time, this resort to everything I don't like is racism or white supremacy. Every Republican candidate is a January 6th rioter. That's sort of the light of hope that I took that. You know what I mean? We're not at the end of the fight yet, but it's kind of that part in the third act where things look really dark and you're like, oh, man, how are we going to get out of this one? And then it's, you know, Gandalf and the Riders of Rohan kind of charging down the hill with the sun rising behind them. Right. Or it's in Aliens, where the second one, where you think the android guy took off with the ship and abandoned them, and then you know you see the ship rising up behind him. I was coming up with all these like cinematic,
nice
metaphors for this, but there is when again Thanos has shown up and is crushing everybody and all of it, it's like, and the guy that you thought was dead from two scenes before shows up again, right? And Doctor Strange opens the portals and all the people who got zapped start pouring out, and it was to me that sort of moment that you sort of forget it's coming. And I think with the Virginia election and including the Winsome Sears part of it, that's sort of taken away that sting of the, oh, you're all white supremacists.
See, you know, I see what you're saying, and I agree to a large extent. I'm more frustrated than relieved in the sense that when everything is called racist, then it's easy to just sort of dismiss racism in general. And so I actually think that that does harm to the larger cause of identifying and fighting real racism, which I believe is a serious and ongoing problem in American society. And so that's the frustration. I mean, it ties into my general frustration with extremists of all sides. But so I don't disagree with you. My feelings are a little bit different. And I'll also say that moving away from the race issue, you know, I think another lesson is don't overreach just in general. I mean, even the New York Times editorial board thinks that this is a real concern. A Thursday, they had an editorial and they wrote, "The concerns of more centrist Americans about a rush to spend taxpayer money, a rush to grow the government, should not be dismissed." That's the New York Times editorial board, Jay.
That's crazy.
You know? So, yeah, and I think I get
before it. Before their position had always been that it should be dismissed. Yeah,
you know? Well, I mean, but
it should be dismissed because you're racist.
But I think that's, you know, I get the impulse because Democrats understand that, you know, come January 2023, they're not going to be able to do basically anything. That's going to be it for the Biden presidency. That's when the investigations start and the legislation grinds to a halt and judicial conference, all that. That's just done, right? So they need to get as much as they can while they can. And so it's easy in that environment to try to do too much. I mean, there's sort of this balance between political capital is there to be spent, because if you just keep on, you know, holding on to it, well, you don't get anything done. And I think it's easy to err on the side of trying to go for a little bit too much. And so I think Democrats maybe are learning this. Certainly, I mean, Joe Manchin has been saying this from the beginning, but a lot of Democrats, I think, are coming to understand this, which is why I think we saw the result with the infrastructure and Build Back Better, because a number of folks in the party and in Congress said, okay, well, we need to really kind of get something done, and we can't overreach on this because we're going to get pounded for it even more than we probably will be. So I think that's an important lesson. And you mentioned this as well earlier. One lesson I draw is don't run against Trump if Trump's not on the ballot. I think that's I mean, Hillary Clinton tried that in 2016, right? And that didn't work out well for her, certainly. And so I think that kind of combines to me with another lesson I picked up, and this has longer term implications as well, is that Democrats shouldn't underestimate Donald Trump and his political team. You know, Trump seems to have been made to realize, I guess, that he has a better chance in 2024 if he can go easier on those sort of demands of you will bow before the big lie, election big lie sort of thing, and just be completely and unquestionably in my corner. And this is really smart on Donald Trump and the Trump political team's side. I'm impressed that they got him to be able to kind of pull back, because he certainly did. He was okay with, you know, not being invited to come and support, you know, Youngkin and that sort of thing. And it's not hard for me to envision a scenario in which enough Republicans and Republican leaners basically become convinced that January 6th was not that big of a deal. And, you know, even if some of Donald Trump's supporters were overly zealous, that doesn't really reflect on Trump himself so much. And considering the alternative, whether it's going to be Biden or Harris, it's better to vote for Trump, who, you know, after all, the constitutional order is still standing. And I mean, I even got a sense of that with you, Jay, honestly. I remember a couple of months ago, I asked you, would you vote for Donald Trump again? And you said no. But then when you were on with Trey, I was like, well, probably not. And I think there's going to be more of that as time goes by. And so it's easier and easier, especially with these signs that Trump is sort of, I think, being more strategic. It's becoming much easier, to my great dismay, for me to see, you know, in January of 2025, Donald Trump taking the oath again.
See, well, to me, I take sort of the opposite lesson from Virginia, in that the Youngkin victory tells other candidates, you don't need Donald Trump out there stumping for you in order to win. Now, you don't want him against you.
Certainly not. No, you have to kind of manage him in that way.
I mean, look, ideally, you don't want anybody against you, right?
Yeah.
Except maybe the Lincoln Project. But So, but yeah, I so I think there's that lesson there that I think other candidates would look at and say, well, you know what, I don't have to, you know, be campaigning with Donald Trump and kissing the ring and all of that. I can run as what you would say in any other year, a sort of traditional Republican type thing. Now, there are a couple other pieces that, again, you and I would disagree on. The, you know, you're the sweep of history, and I'm maybe looking more at what actually happens, the facts on the ground type thing. Yonkin's position as a first time politician also allowed him maybe some more space,
yeah,
from Donald Trump, as opposed to someone who is a party member, had necessarily been on board with endorsing him as he was the president and so forth. So yeah, that's what I mean. A candidate like Yonkin maybe has a little more breathing room than someone who, say, has been in office for years and was in office throughout the Trump presidency.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. So if we think about, again, how this, what this portends, if anything, I think some for the midterms, you know, when I look at, again, those big, larger factors, right? And I think there are a number of things right now that are a big drag on Democrats. COVID, obviously, the supply chain issues, the shortages, right? Inflation, and still the fact that these bills, well, the infrastructure was just passed, but Build Back Better has not yet been passed. But I think if we kind of push forward into the summer of 2022, and that's really when the midterm election season is going to start in earnest. I mean, my prediction is that inflation will be down, though there will still be a ways to go. It's not going to be at that 2%. I think that supply chain issues will probably be a little bit better. COVID should be less of an issue. Infrastructure, we know that passed. Build Back Better, I think, will have passed. And those benefits, though, I think Democrats who think that, well, once those are passed, people are going to be like, wow, right, this is great. I mean, these are over a decade.
Nothing's really shovel ready.
No, and it's going to take years for these things to really be felt. And so, again, even though a lot of these headwinds are going to be lessened for Democrats, I think I'm still not optimistic, because if you take, again, if you take a look at those historical factors, it's almost guaranteed that the party in power, they're going to lose some seats in the midterms. And not only that, but it's not just the House, where I think Republicans are looking to pick up a dozen or more seats, it would be my guess at this point. But you look at the Senate. Now, most of those Senate elections, relatively safe seats, even though Republicans are defending more seats than Democrats, there are only really four races that seem to me that are going to be kind of toss-up competitive. And in three of those, Arizona, Nevada, and Georgia, they're currently held by Democrats. Pennsylvania's the fourth one. I expect in January 2023, the House has a solid Republican majority. There's a 52 Republicans in the Senate. And then I think it would be weird, it would be implausible not to think that there would be all sorts of investigations of the Biden administration and, you know, again, legislative progress just grinds to a complete halt. And that, I think, is going to set the stage for, you know, a potential Trump comeback in 2024. Because at least to me, given how the Republican primary process is structured, Donald Trump has to be the favorite, assuming his health and energy and so forth hold out. And so, I mean, if I had to bet, I would say that there's a totally reasonable chance that Donald Trump will be the next president of the United States.
I'm not willing to go that far at this point. I sort of certainly agree with you on the midterms.
Yeah.
Right. In terms of one, the big historical sweep, and you lose seats in and off here. And this is what I wanted to go back to, just because this is a fun little fact that I just learned last week with the Virginia governor's election. Virginia governors, Mike, cannot run for two consecutive terms.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that?
Yeah.
Maybe you did know that. I did not know that. So on the one hand, every Virginia gubernatorial race is to some extent an open seat. You can have someone who was governor before, like Terry McAuliffe, but you don't have an actual incumbent running. And the second weird thing is the timing is that Virginia's governor is always elected the year after the presidential election. which again is just a little weird. A lot of governors are elected in off years, but the first year just seems sort of weird. So I just thought that was like a funny curiosity thing that I did not know about Virginia, is also that they're the lieutenant governor separately elected. But going back to the bigger sweep of history stuff. Yeah. I think that the party in power usually loses seats. And as you are correct in all the headwinds, I think inflation will still be high going into next summer. I don't see the supply chain stuff getting sorted out in any meaningful way by then for a whole lot of reasons. But I think it's you're right on there. Now, I don't necessarily make that final step of saying therefore Donald Trump will be the next president, but.
But maybe
that's a prediction for another day.
Yeah, maybe you'll go so far to say, therefore, especially considering how party primaries work, therefore, it certainly eases the path toward a Donald Trump renomination.
Yeah, I think so. But yeah. But keep in mind also that the primaries, I mean, we haven't started there. And I would say in most of these states, whoever the Trump candidate is, probably has the inside track on winning that primary.
Yeah.
But again, the Yonkin example says something, right? And it's not a lesson that's going to be absorbed every place, and it wouldn't work every place. But I think there are going to be candidates who say, yeah, I can be lukewarm on Trump. I don't have to be. You know, for like example, in the Ohio Senate primary right now, it's a competition to who can out Trump Trump.
Yeah.
I don't know that necessarily is going to work. And plus, when these folks get in the general elections, there are places where, look in solid red states. Okay, the Trumpian person probably cruises to victory no matter what. In less red states, like in Arizona, for example. I don't know that that's the case, right? And Arizona also just has its weird Barry Goldwater, John McCain, Maverick streak type thing. I agree that the Trumpian candidates would have the inside track. I don't necessarily think does that translate to a Trump friendly environment in 2020. I'm not.
See, my thinking is in part. What I see happening in a little more detail is once the House and probably the Senate are again controlled by Republicans, I think you agree that the investigation machinery will kick in as it has. This is just what happens, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And so I think then the narrative is going to be it will be the Biden-Harris administration, because they're going to be looking to 2024. The incredible corruption of the Biden-Harris administration, regardless
we are going to learn a lot about the art world and art sales, yeah, I anticipate.
But I mean, regardless of the specifics, that's going to be the narrative, which I think makes sense to set up the sort of whataboutism type of thing, saying, sure, Donald Trump was corrupt, maybe, did some stuff, maybe, played fast and loose with the Constitution, maybe, but So did Joe Biden, yeah, and Kamala Harris. And so therefore, weighing that, well, you know, Trump's going to cut taxes and, you know, build a wall and be against critical race theory. So I'm okay.
But so would most any other Republican candidate.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But
I guess that's the way I look at it, is the longer Donald Trump is out of office, the less he matters.
I think you could also
have a situation where there are plenty of people who, let's say they run for the Senate or House in 2022 and use, you know, ride in on the Donald Trump coattails. But by 2024, again, maybe you don't need Trump as much as you think you need him.
I agree with that. But I also think, or at least I think that's plausible. But I also, again, go back to sort of fundamentals and structures. And given what we know about primary voters and how much more extreme and committed they are, and given that that's sort of Donald Trump's base in the party, and given his huge fundraising apparatus and his you know, pretty significant super PAC leadership PAC organization, it just seems to me that that he is, if he want, assuming again his health and his energy hold out, and he wants to, this is basically, it's going to be in 2024 his nomination to lose, and he just will come into it just so much stronger than anyone else.
Okay, we'll see. We'll see.
I know we both hope that's not the case, for you know, for somewhat similar reasons, but yeah, we will definitely see. Hey, you know, before we close today, I was saying to you, Jay, before the show yesterday, actually, that I've been off for 2 weeks and my recommendations are stacking up like cargo containers at the Long Beach port, and so there are a few things I would like to recommend, actually, and one of them you will appreciate, Jay, is Democracy in America by Alexis de Tocqueville. I just finished rereading.
I do appreciate that.
I had a copy of it for forever, but it'd been, you know, it's one of those books that you have on your shelf, maybe. It's more, I think, admired than actually read. And
right.
It, you know,
it's like you read portions of it when you're in college and then, yeah.
Well, I assigned the entire thing to my class, for better or for worse. And it's, you know, 700 and something pages. And in all honesty, it reminded me in some points of kind of like a Stephen King or Tom Clancy saying, like, God, this guy could have used a little bit of editing. That's not really how it worked back then. It would have been a much tighter 500 pages, but yeah, it might have lost some of its charm. But generally speaking, there's a reason why it is a classic, and there is a lot one can take away from it. And the nice thing about it is the way it's structured in terms of the parts in the chapters. Chapters only tend to be a few pages. You don't necessarily have to read it through from cover to cover. I would suggest starting at the beginning.
Right. But Mike, you should tell the story for people who aren't familiar necessarily.
The story? Help me out here.
Well, with what it's about, what.
Well, this French nobleman is given a commission to go to the United States in 1835 to study the prison system, basically. And he stays there for about 10 months or so. He decides he is going to be much more broad in his views. And it's essentially a study. It's not really written.
Gonzo journalism.
It's not written for Americans. It was written really for Europeans saying, hey, here's this newish thing, this democracy in America. And he basically compares it to the benefits and the drawbacks of aristocratic systems. And he ends up sort of having kind of a two cheers for democracy type of American democracy sort of thing. There's a lot he admires about America. And he thinks that democracy overall is better than the European aristocratic system. But he also believes that there are some important things that are lost. And I think that I think there's a lot of democratic boosterism, and for good reasons. But I think Tocqueville makes some really important points about conservative aristocratic arguments for things that actually are lost in sort of a pell-mell push toward complete equality and democracy. And not to say that we shouldn't move in those directions, and certainly that it wasn't a good thing to move in those directions, and given where we were in 1835 and 1840 when he wrote parts one and two, but that, you know, we should look at these things, well, critically. You know, and so critical democratic theory, if you will, I think it's kind of an example of that. And it's really, it gave me some things to think about. It reminded me of what drew me to conservatism as a political philosophy in the first place. And I recommend that everyone at least, you know, pick it. It's public domain. You can find all sorts of free versions of it. And at least, you know, page through it, because there's a lot of wisdom in that book, a lot of things that should, you know, I think are worth thinking about. So yeah, that's my recommendation for this week.
So that's a good one. My recommendation, and I may have recommended this writer in various aspects before, but I think the Kevin Williamson is the greatest writer operating in the English language today. He writes a lot for National Review, but he has a book that was sort of a compilation of a lot of his columns, which is Big White Ghetto, which I recommend. But more fun, because it is pretty much short form type journalism, is he has a newsletter called The Tuesday that you can sign up for, and you get every Tuesday in your inbox a column from Kevin Williamson. And he is always fun and entertaining. And he also does a lot on language and linguistics, which is something that I'm just sort of a geek for. But if you're in Williamson, also, it's kind of interesting. He no longer identifies himself as a Republican, in part because of Trump, in part because of other things. But he is very much a fresh voice on the right, and just a lot of fun to read. So.
Hey, well, you know, and I am familiar with Big White Ghetto, and you know why. JJ generously gave me a copy of Big White Ghetto, and Williamson, I agree, is a interesting writer, well worth reading, even if you don't agree with him. I wasn't aware of the Tuesday newsletter. I'm going to sign up for that. So would you say that you enjoy Williamson now more than Jonah Goldberg?
In some ways, like, Jonah Goldberg is more like, I feel like sort of almost a peer. Like, I feel like I could hang out with Jonah Goldberg.
He reminds me of you in so many ways.
And Jonah, if you're listening, I'm up I'm forever, whatever. I've met Jonah Goldberg at one point. He autographed a book for me. But I feel a bit, Kevin Williamson is just sort of like on the next level, right? And again, that's no offense to Jonah Goldberg. But as a writer, right? I do admire Jonah Goldberg as a writer. Kevin Williamson is just sort of, next level. And has that same sort of, this is what I aspire to. It's almost this grasp of the big historical stuff and the references to, you can refer to Shakespeare, Plutarch, Tocqueville and all the big names, but then also this wonderful sort of like earthiness and a pop culture understanding and getting how it all really kind of fits together.
I see what you're saying. Goldberg is much more on the kind of on that pop culture kind of earthiness level.
Well,
can bring some of that in, whereas Williamson is maybe a mix that you find more aspirational. Okay.
Yeah. That's no offense to Jonah.
No, Goldberg. Not at all.
I mean, I just, yeah.
Not at all. They're both well worth reading. Like I said, for years I've been a huge fan of Goldberg, and I will add the Williamson Tuesday newsletter to it. So I appreciate that recommendation. All right. So, there was so much that we didn't get to. We want to talk about the International Climate Conference and two really important Supreme Court cases that went for oral arguments this week, the New York gun control law and the Texas abortion bill, as well as the Senate's filibuster of the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. And we will get to that on the bonus show, which Jay and I will be recording in just a minute, and that will be available to supporters, well, by the time you can hear this. And so if you're not a supporter, patreon.com/politicsguys. You can sign up to become a supporter. And again, if you'd just like to get that bonus show, but you can't afford to support the show, send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will make that happen. Something that doesn't cost anything and that really matters to us is subscribing to the show. So if you haven't, we really appreciate that. Leaving ratings and reviews on the podcast app of your choice, and especially if you would share episodes on social media. If you want to get in touch with us for whatever reason, you can do that on Facebook and Twitter. You'll find links in the show notes, as well as our email, mail@politicsguys.com. And as always, a special thanks to our wonderful executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, Chris Wilkerson, and Ryan Beasley. We'll be back with a new show next week. We hope you'll join us.